Hey folks, you're listening to the third episode of a podcast that does not have a name until the end of this episode.
Right. This is us figuring out what we're doing, in case you haven't realized that by this point.
The idea is we're going to take our favorite little turn of phrase from this episode and we'll make it into our title. So you're going to witness it basically as it happens. With your ears.
Mm-hmm. Ear witness. Which I suppose is a thing, but that's like not a term that you hear, really.
No, ear witness testimony is not worth a lot in court.
Ear witness news.
Radio news casts in a much different light.
Yeah.
So this episode we're talking about the visceral, right? I looked up visceral to make sure that I understood it correctly.
Actually, so did I.
Like, let's agree to do that. Now, what does it mean? Visceral is, like, the things that get you in your gut. It's not an intellectual experience, but...
Of the body.
Yeah.
According to Webster.
It's the stuff that reaches you on a deeper level than your brain. I have a book, a movie, and a video game.
That is actually what I have as well, kind
Excellent. Of. Excellent. You want to do pairs?
I have kind of an order.
Okay, you go with your order. I'm fine.
Which is around. It's video game, movie, book.
Sure.
Do you want?
If you want to.
Okay. I don't remember who went first last week. I don't think it matters. No. But okay. So, I'm going to start this by saying that I was kind of a wuss as a kid. I was easily frightened, not like a fan of horror movies or anything like that. That's something that kind of took until I got like older and a little more socialized, I suppose. So when I started thinking about like visceral reactions, I was trying to think of like, okay, what are possible visceral reactions? And one of the first things that occurred to me, like, was basically a fear response.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, sweat, muscles tensing, like, feeling physically freaked out by something. And so I thought back to, like, okay, what's the time that I remember that happening? And I'm going back to 1999 specifically, which is why I specified that I was kind of a wuss as a kid. Because 1999 saw the release of a video game that got a lot of talk. It spawned a series that is still going. There's a couple of movies based on it. It regularly shows up on like best games lists and stuff like that. So like, I was like, all right, I'm going to try this. I'm a little 14-year-old me is going to get a ride with my mom down to Movie Time Video. We're going to rent this game. And it scared the fucking shit out of me. And that game is Silent Hill. The original. Which was released by Konami in January of 1999 in North America, according to Wikipedia. It was directed and primarily written, I gather, by Keiichiro Toyama. And programmed by Hiroyuki Owaka for credits purposes. So the basic premise of Silent Hill is you play this kind of ordinary everyman fella named Harry Mason, who's taken a vacation with his adopted daughter, Cheryl, I think is her name. And at the beginning of the game, you know, you're driving through this town and you get into a car accident. And when you wake up, Cheryl is gone. And so you're basically trying to find her. So you stumble into the nearby town, the town of Silent Hill, and it kind of goes off the rails pretty damn quickly. What I have written on like my little note sheet here is, daughter Cheryl goes missing in freaky town, demonic cults folders into reality, the usual. So, okay. What specifically, like, I'm going to focus, like, the whole kind of atmosphere and aura of the game, like, really freaked the crap out of me. But I'm going to focus, like, specifically on a particular element within that. And that is this mechanic that the game has. So this is, like I said, it's 1999, it's PlayStation 1. This is, like, the post-pixel, low-polygon art era. For, like, not game people, ugly, blocky shapes, basically. Like, they hadn't figured out how to, like, really stylize that aesthetically very well yet. This game was kind of part of the process of the transition between, like, the pixel 2D gaming and the kind of photorealistic crap that we have now.
Yeah, they just didn't have the power to create that many faces on a shape.
Exactly. And part of that lack of processing power also meant that, like, even though you're in a 3D environment, like, distance rendering, not super great.
Yeah.
Basically, the computer can't think of the stuff that's far away from you, so it doesn't show up until you, like, walk toward it, and then it suddenly appears. Like, they call it pop-up, that kind of thing. The way this game gets around that is that it is set almost entirely in the dark, with a flashlight that you are carrying as your only source of light, or in, like, a big, creepy, foggy mist. So either way, like, you can't see very far from you, and that's part of the mechanic of the game. And they give you a radio. And what this radio does is, whenever something dangerous is approaching you, and when I say something dangerous, I mean, like, legs sewn together somehow wielding a knife, small demon children, mutated nurses with giant parasites growing out of their backs, some, like, freaky shit. Whenever danger is beginning to approach you, the radio will start to crackle static with increasing frequency and intensity as it gets closer. And so this, in particular, stands out, first of all, because static is a freaky sound anyway. Like, there's just something kind of, I don't know, removed about it. Like, it's a machine sound that is incomprehensible, and, like, human intelligence wants to find patterns, but it is patternless. Like, that kind of thing. So it's a freaky sound to begin with. And also, it gives you the sense that, like, okay, something is coming to kill me right now. And I was thinking about that in particular, and, like, why does that freak me out so much? Because, like, as an adult now, like, I have that kind of, like, mental remove where it's like, it's just a game, it's fine, whatever. Like, hey, that monster just ate me, great. It's like, yeah, it's tearing my legs off. All right. But especially as a kid, like, that was not quite as well developed. And I think video games tap into it very particular, because particularly, especially? Anyway, video games really tap into it because kind of the crux and the purpose of a game is, like, you are interacting with it, you are making decisions, which means that those decisions have consequences. So, like, the idea of danger approaching is really the idea of, like, I'm going to do something wrong. And that is a fear that I have in my life anyway. Like, I'm an anxious motherfucker. So I think that's a big part of, like, why that scared me more than, I don't know, something else scary, some horror movie or something. And, like, why it affected me very physically is, like, responding to the idea of, like, okay, what's coming is a chance for me to fuck up. What I have on the paper is, like, that sound equals you're gonna get fucked by what the fuck is that? Which I thought was a good note.
Increasing levels of profanity as the static gets closer.
Exactly, yeah. It tends to happen. Cursing at video games is, you know, one of those rare pleasures in life.
It is, isn't it?
Mm.
Started my 6th playthrough of Skyrim, and, like, just every time that somebody comes up to me with a quest I've already done 4 or 5 times, and I know I don't want to do it again. Like, what the fuck do you think you're doing? Do you know who I am? I'm someone who's already helped you 5 times. Get out of my fucking face.
Like, do you know who I am is great for, like, all of Skyrim.
Like, everybody knows who you are for a different reason.
Yeah, but, like, none of them seem to care that you have important things to do.
They're like, yeah, this guy just spends, like, 3/4 of his time cycling shops. Don't go for speech as a main skill, guys. I'm learning that the hard way. It'll come with time.
I think of cursing at video games, like, my mind immediately goes to Mario Kart.
Oh, God. The game that was made to be cursed at.
Yeah. It's like, you blue shelling me on the rainbow road, you... Just long beeping sounds. So that was my first one.
All right, Silent Hill, definitely a visceral game.
Yeah.
I went with something that's kind of a horror game.
Okay.
It's the first season of the Telltale Games' Walking Dead game.
Aha.
This got released between 12 and 2014. You see, I switched it up there. Now, I have not played the second season all the way through yet. I played the first chapter, and it was such a visceral experience that it made me hesitate to go back. And in fact, normally I've gone back and like replayed some game or like rewatched some movie, reread some book for this. I did not touch Walking Dead again. I read the Wikipedia article on it because it is such an emotionally raw game in general that it starts to get to you on a visceral level. They set you up at the very beginning, and I'm going to talk a little bit about a summary of what goes on initially, but they set you up, and every time that you're making a decision in the game, dialogue or like action, what you're physically going to do, it is setting you up to fail and hurt somebody by accident.
Ooh.
Or on purpose. You're basically choosing between hurting people on accident and on purpose in this game.
Okay.
And your survival is so tied up with everybody being safe and in agreement that they should be surviving the same way that it hits you very deeply when something throws that balance off, because all of a sudden, none of you are going to make it. That's what it looks like. So this game starts, you are in the back of a squad car, and you have only the vaguest of suggestions through dialogue as to why you're there. You don't know what crime you've committed until you get a little bit further into the game, and through this conversation with the police officer. Basically, it turns out that you have murdered a man having an affair with your wife.
Hmm.
You used to be a university professor, and now you're about to be locked up, but the zombie outbreak happens.
Convenient.
You meet this small child who literally has no protection except for you, if you choose to help her. Which you do, because you have to, right? It's like an 8-year-old girl.
Yeah.
Her name is Clementine, and she is sweet. You meet a bunch of other survivors. You are forced within the first hour of the game to make a choice between saving an able-bodied adult who can help you in a zombie apocalypse, or another small child. You can only save one. Mm. You find out that your parents are dead. You meet someone who knows your past, and you have to figure out whether or not you're going to let them get eaten by a zombie. You are forced to kill your reanimated brother. You get knocked out by a vengeful character who doesn't trust you, and then have to somehow reassemble your group anyway. And all of that is chapter 1 out of 5.
Oh. Good God.
You're also going to have to deal with cannibals, bandits, child murder, survivalists who will brutally murder you, trading sex for survival, assisted suicide, self-mutilation, abortion by way of intentional miscarriage, and how your choices all manage to destroy a man's family no matter what you do.
Hmm. How long are these chapters?
It's a Telltale game, so we're talking between
comparable
an hour and 2 hours for
each
chapter, depending on how much you go into the background to try to discover everything.
The only Telltale I played was Wolf Among Us, which was good, but did not seem that quickly paced.
That's the thing. I mean, it seems slowly paced. It seems like you're constantly being stifled with your inability to actually act or change anything. You feel paralyzed when you're playing the game because they just set it up in such a way that the odds are so stacked against you. Survival is probably guaranteed against.
Okay.
And so these things have to constantly be happening to reinforce it, And I mean, you do get a say in all of these things, but you're always running away from something, really.
Yeah, dealing with a crisis within a crisis within a crisis.
Oof. It's an incredible game. It is the kind of thing where you push the chair away at the end and you're like, I'm glad that I did it, but I'm probably not going to do it again for like a long time, if at all.
Yeah.
So I mean, it for me, through the emotional side, I don't know, I feel like ordinarily they try to get you on a deeper level than emotions to mm-hmm. give you action, but it works. So that's The Walking Dead from Telltale.
I'm curious about that, because like, I read a fair chunk of the comic,
mm-hmm.
Like kind of all in one go, like God, a long time ago now, 10 years ago. I think maybe up to whatever was out then, at least in like the collected format.
Mm-hmm.
And I dug that, and then like I tried to watch the TV show and got sick of it pretty quickly.
They depart pretty far, I understand, from comic books.
Right.
I guess the video games are a lot closer.
Okay.
They're headed up by a guy, for the first season, he wrote the vast majority of it and was a creative director for the thing. His name's Sean Vanneman.
Hmm.
From what I understand, he worked really closely with Robert Kirkman to keep things at least in more the spirit of the Walking Dead graphic novels.
Okay. I would love to see Telltale take on League of Extraordinary Gentlemen, by the way.
Ooh, that would be a lot of fun.
Like, that's such a good one. Alright, we'll save that for another time.
It's still surprising to me that they took on the Borderlands world.
Hmm.
Doesn't seem like it would be ripe for a Telltale game series, but it was a really good game.
Huh. That's not one I know, so I will have to file that away.
Tales from the Borderlands,
okay.
Voiced partially by Chris Hardwick.
Oh. Alright. What's it about?
You play two different, like, one of them is a Hyperion business suit. Like, he's just the definition of, like, a dude who does middle management for a weapons company.
Okay.
And then the other one is a con artist, and they get forced into a sort of, like, pushed together by fate, and they're basically they're trying to become vault hunters. Each of them has their own, like, sort of sidekick, so the four of you make up, like, the main character core.
Okay.
But they pull in a lot of stuff from the Borderlands world, including Handsome Jack, who seems to be, like, the mascot of that. That, I mean, it's like Claptrap and Handsome Jack are the mascots of the Borderlands world, but...
Yeah.
Fortunately, there's no Claptrap in Tales from the Borderlands.
I'm kind of shrugging right now. I've heard of Handsome Jack, but I don't know what it is.
Handsome Jack is a character who is... entertaining in the way that Borderlands is entertaining. You know, he tells you that he's gonna have you crushed by his diamond horse, which is named Butt Stallion.
Okay. That sets a tone.
Yeah. So anyway.
Yeah. Alright, moving on.
Yeah, let's talk about movies.
Indeed. Okay. So... as you know, but people listening may not, I went to college for film. And it took a couple of cracks at the wheel to make it around. But the annoying thing about that is, like, very few of the credits that I took in, like, the first couple of universities that I went to really transferred over. So, like, when I went the last time, I... basically, it ended up doing the whole 4 years again.
Eesh.
But that meant, like, I was a little bit of an older student, had a little bit of background in this thing, which was helpful, and it led to this experience, which was taking I forget what it was called, but it was essentially the Film 101 class at PSU. It was a requirement for film majors, obviously, but it was also, like, one of the things you could take to fulfill an elective credit. So it was a big class full of people who are not necessarily film people. Mostly freshmen, also.
Ooh.
So here I am, sitting in, like, the back of this room of, like, 100 18-year-olds. And, you know, some other students mixed in there, too, to be fair. But and the professor comes in and kind of gives the intro spiel about syllabi and, you know, things college professors talk about. And then is like, okay, so I'm going to show you guys a classic movie, and we're going to talk about it afterwards. And the lights go down, and he puts on Un Chien Andalou. I think I'm saying that right. I do not speak French. Also, I find it funny that two Spanish guys named their movie in French. Those two Spanish guys were, by the way, Salvador Dali, who, you know, is an artist that people generally know, mostly for his painting The Persistence of Memory, which was from 1931, so 2 years after this film. The other guy was Louis Buñuel, who is a filmmaker of some note. Some of his more famous films, other than this one, include Viridiana, 1961, Belle du Jour, 1967, The Discreet Charm of the Bourgeoisie, 1972, which is also the only other one I've seen, and That Obscure Object of Desire, 1977. So they collaborated on two films, of which this was the first, the other L'Age d'Or. Again, don't speak French. But it's a famous silent film. It's a surrealist film. And what kind of brings me to my point is that it opens with a very famous sequence in which a man goes out and kind of stares at the moon, and the clouds are going across the moon. And then he goes inside, grabs a woman's face, takes a razor blade, and slices open her eyeball. So what's really fun is listening to 100 18-year-olds all go, "Ah!" all at the same time.
That's excellent.
The film doesn't really have a plot. It is a surrealist exploration. Basically, Buñuel and Dali got together and came up with this kind of idea of using images to explore the idea of repressed human emotions, but in, you know, a true surrealist fashion without any direct symbolism. Like, it's more just about automatic. It's about what an image feels like without thinking about it too much.
Mm-hmm.
So, like, in addition to the eyeball slicing, you have stuff like, I think there's a part where a couple of pianos with, like, donkey carcasses in them are, like, crawling across the floor in stop motion. There's a part where a guy, like, looks at his hand and there's a hole in it and ants are crawling out. That sort of thing. I have a soft spot for surrealism, by the way, in case you couldn't tell.
This film sounds delightful.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's 21 minutes long, so, like, it's not a hell of a commitment. But what's interesting about it for the purposes of this episode are, like, the ability to kind of evoke that feeling. Like, it's... I'm pausing to organize my thoughts here. Okay. So, when we studied this film, like, one of the interpretation that we learned of that was, like, the eyeball splitting scene, was that cinema had become a new way of seeing, and it was destroying the old way of seeing. Like, that's kind of an explanation that cinephiles like, I think, because it justifies the art and all of that. But I think what's kind of a more interesting way to approach it, and more in line with what they were doing, with, like, this is the exploration of a feeling, is it's like, okay, building on the idea from Silent Hill that, like, what was scary about that was games are choices. Like, this is something that is not a choice. Like, it is not me that is experiencing this directly. And yet, I'm having a response to it.
Mm-hmm.
Which kind of addresses... I don't know, there's a couple potential kind of explanations of that. Like, one is, you know, basically just a sensitivity to danger. Like, we see that happening and, like, okay, something dangerous is around because, like, the lizard part of our brain doesn't comprehend the abstract. But I think there's also an empathic response to it. As it speaks to the idea that... How do I want to say this? We identify with art, I guess. With the expression within it, like, the idea that, like, this is somehow an embodiment of another person, whether, like, directly representationally, as in most cases, or in something like this, which has, like, an element of that, but also this element of, like, kind of raw thought happening. Mm-hmm. But seeing something like that, where it's, like, I'm kind of losing myself a little bit here because this is, like, very airy stuff.
Yeah, all concept.
Yeah. I'm going to read what I wrote. That would probably be helpful. Actually, I kind of reached the end of what I wrote. But I guess it's just the idea that, like, it's playing on this empathy that exists on kind of a subconscious. Like, we are a social species. Mm-hmm. As such, like, we respond to things in each other, and art is a way to play with that. And they are using cinema to do that in particular, and I think it's significant that the film kind of begins with that.
Right.
Because, like, it's, first of all, it shocks you into paying attention, and second of all, it's, like, a very raw example of that kind of immediacy and automatic... What's the noun form of automatic? Automation, maybe?
Yeah.
I forget the word that I just said before that because I was thinking about automation, but, like, that kind of automatic art,
mm-hmm,
that they were trying to do, like, this is poking right at that. So that's why that's cool.
So without this surrealist portion, I think that the film that I picked is kind of story-driven exploration of the same thing that you're talking about.
Okay.
I went with a film from 2015 called Sleeping Giant.
I remember you telling me about this and saying...
So the way that this movie... I love the way that this movie was given to me. Mm-hmm. I was talking to a friend at work. A lot of times if I'm, like, in a conversation with somebody and it flags for a second, I just ask, like, my go-to curious question about them, which is, what's your favorite movie? Or, like, what's your favorite TV show? What's your favorite video game? Like, mm-hmm, what game? Just tell me about what you like and why you like it. I find that fascinating. That's why we do this.
Yeah, I was just gonna say, that sounds familiar.
So, yeah, I asked, what's your favorite movie? And the girl I was talking to was, like, an 18-year-old homeschooled girl who had very, very unique tastes because she was... At an age where she'd been able to seek a lot of stuff out on her own and not be shaped by forces,
mm-hmm,
normal socialization. So, let me write that down real quick. I'll cut this out.
Yeah. That is kind of one of my plans for this weekend, is to, like, actually sit down and do the editing.
Right. Yeah, so she goes, oh, my favorite movie is called Sleeping Giant. And I go, cool, like, what's it about? And so she tells me a little bit, and basically the way she explains it is, it's this movie about this kid who spends a summer hanging out on a lake with his family, and he meets these two guys, and he hangs out with them a bunch.
Okay.
And I was like, and that's your, like, favorite movie? And she goes,
I'm waiting for the other shoe to drop.
Right. The whole movie is waiting for the other shoe to drop. So I go, that's your favorite movie? And she goes, yeah, but I'm never going to watch it again. And I was like, it's your favorite, mm-hmm, movie, but you're never going to watch it again? And she goes, yeah, I'm not going to watch it again. So this has me, like, the most curious I've ever been about a movie.
Yeah.
That's, like, the ringing endorsement.
I'm
right?
Very curious and a little scared myself.
My experience, I watched the movie... And as soon as I finished it, I said, yeah, I'm never going to watch that again, but it's one of my favorite movies. And I ended up watching it again to talk about it for this, but, I mean, like, it stands up. I'm glad I watched it a second time. Okay. So let's get into the movie. Sleeping Giant is set on Lake Superior. It opens with these really ominous shots, just, like, on the lake, skimming past these massive, dark stone cliffs. And... about 11 minutes, they set it up, this is the cliff. This cliff is, like, 15 feet high or something. And somebody, one of the characters goes, you think you could jump off that? And the adult with them goes, Darwin Award, first prize. So they've set up the stakes. You jump off of this thing, you gonna die.
Mm.
So the movie proper, it's this 13-year-old boy. He's always been kind of sheltered. He's like a very quiet kid. He meets these two kids who are cousins. Riley and... what is the other kid's name? Andrew, maybe? It doesn't matter too much because they're just these archetypes. These like, bad kids. One of them's a little bit more grown. The other one's smaller, but definitely a smart mouth. Like... Mm. They've got this thing going on. They pull all kinds of escapades over the summer. They steal a bunch of beer and hard liquor from, like, the island store. At one point, they find, a dead seagull hanging from a branch. One of them screams, "It's Christmas!" They set to work beating this thing with sticks, throwing rocks at it, crushing its body, just absolutely wreaking havoc.
Okay. I can see something on the horizon here, then.
So... That's the thing about this movie. Most scenes last less than 2 minutes. Pretty much everything is a single shot of, like, it's a close-up of a bug being burned to death for 45 seconds.
Okay.
It's a shot of these guys out in the woods, like, watching insects have sex and then smacking them and destroying them. It's about these fleeting conversations where they just insult each other, but they're bonding. Everything about the movie hits you on a visceral level because it's not giving you the time to establish, like, a proper story. You're following, like, five distinct storylines, but they're really more of just things that happen more than once in slightly changed ways.
Okay.
What you're watching is the experience of this kid growing and changing over the course of a summer under the influence of both his father, who you learn a lot of stuff about, and these two cousins, and the thing that really just sells for me, like, defines what it's going for, is there's a point where one character says to another, "Why you always gotta fuck things up?" And his immediate response is, "It's fun!" So I mentioned at the beginning that there's the cliff and the consequence. And that's really the crux of the film. It's a movie about a consequenceless summer, like we've all experienced.
Mm-hmm.
But then there's the consequence. Two characters climb up this rock and make the jump. I'm not going to tell you how it wraps up, but two people do make that jump. And it's a really intense film throughout, because you... always can tell that something is going to go wrong, and a couple times it does, but then you go right back to feeling like something still has yet to go wrong. It's that film that just is always on your nerves. Ooh. And is always getting you.
Yeah.
I'm so excited for you to watch it, and I'm so excited for any listener who wants to watch it. It's on Netflix, directed by this guy, Andrew Cividino. I want to find out... I believe it's the only thing that he's created so far.
Hmm.
But I want to find out more about this guy. I want to keep an eye on him because it's something special, this Sleeping Giant.
Yeah, now I'm really curious. That's going to be a ride, though.
It is. It you know, it's funny. It's a it's like the sweet spot for films. It's like an hour 45.
Hmm.
It simultaneously feels much shorter and much longer.
Okay. That is already sounds like a perfect example, because, like, I don't have a verbal response to that. I'm just kind of cringing at, like, the expectation of that feeling.
Yeah, as soon as you said visceral, I was like, Sleeping Giant, what else am I going to do?
Oh, man. Did you ever see Gummo?
Gummo, no.
Okay.
Is it something I should write down?
Of the people I know, you are one of the few that I would say maybe check it out.
Gummo?
Yep. It's by Harmony Korine. It came out in 97, I think. And it's very... in that same, like, when you were describing, like, it's a bunch of short scenes that only kind of sort of connect and are all, like, really weird and sort of fucked up. Like, that's what it made me think of.
Yeah.
So, I don't remember it that well, to be honest. It's been quite some time, but, like, I kind of want to rewatch it now and see if it holds up, because I remember enjoying it at the time, but I know it's also a movie that, like, is very divisive.
Those are good ones, usually.
Yeah.
I mean, at least to have seen.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of it's a bellwether, you know? It's like, you watch The Godfather, and it's like, if you hate The Godfather, you're just doing a hot take, shut up, it's good. And, like, there are movies that are, like, obviously bad. But then there's that weird middle ground where it's like, no, you have to have an opinion on this.
Yeah, and not like the... Like, did they try too hard, but, like...
Yeah.
What are they doing? Mm-hmm. And does it matter? Should they be doing it?
Yeah. Actually, my third thing kind of falls into that sometimes. Okay, so when I was thinking about visceral reactions, like, I thought about a fear reaction. But I also thought about... a nausea reaction, because that's also one that I get a lot. So, and this third thing kind of, it took me a long time to really kind of come up with it, because I was trying to go a different way with it. I was trying to, like, well, what about something positive, like a song that gets me, like, really pumped or something. But then I remembered this experience reading a short story online. And that short story is Guts by Chuck Palahniuk.
Oh, yeah. I think I know which one you're talking about.
With the pool.
Yeah, that's all you gotta say.
Yeah. That's actually how I found it. I was like, Chuck Palahniuk short story pool, and it was the first thing that popped up.
Yeah, that later became a part of a short story collection he did. I'm trying to remember the name of it. Ghost Stories, I want to say.
Okay. I did not know that part. I do know it was originally published in Playboy in March 2004. And, as I just mentioned, is on the internet to be read, like chuckpalahniuk.net or whatever. That's where I found it and reread it. And the rereading of it is kind of an interesting aspect of this. But first, it's... a first-person narrative about someone in, like, his late teens, I guess, or maybe early 20s by the time of the narration.
Thereabouts.
How to put this delicately, is interested in exploring the sexual envelope, but in a... solitary, masturbatory sort of way.
Right.
The first part of the story kind of covers earlier explorations in this. I believe some talk is mentioned of inserting rods.
Sounding.
Yes. That.
Which I find inherently funny because I don't want to think about it too hard.
Exactly. But then it, devolves or evolves or shifts into a particular incident. And, like, I don't want to spoil too much of it, but I do have to talk about it a little bit to explain the reaction. So it involves masturbating underwater, which he's doing in a pool, which has an intake at the bottom of the pool. And, you know, by sitting on that intake while doing this, it increases the experience until you get stuck. And then, in order to reach the air, you basically have to kind of turn your guts inside out in the pool. And it is a description of this experience. The first time I read it is one of very few times that I can remember thinking, that was fucked up, why did I read that? And this is coming from somebody who, like, one of my favorite books as a teenager was Naked Lunch. So, my threshold is pretty up there. But, I don't know, something about it, like, when I was 21 or whatever, and reading it, was very just, like, it hit me in a very, like, negative way. Like, my body responded to it, like, just like, oh, God. In a way that that sort of thing usually doesn't. And, like, that kind of stood out for me. And in rereading it this time, I noticed something interesting about that. And that was that, like, that reaction being what I remember, it kind of eclipsed the more nuanced content of the story. Mm-hmm. And this kind of, like, gets to this sort of... I have not read much Chuck Palahniuk, to be fair. Like, obviously I've seen Fight Club, but I've never read it. And I did read Invisible Monsters. I liked that one a lot when I read it, which was, like, at age 18, so I don't know. But, like... And I think one or two other short stories, but I can't remember what they are now. Like, not a lot, but, like, all of it was, like, kind of had this similar feeling where it was like, it's really interesting that this is doing this, but I don't know what it's doing. I don't...
Right. He does like to challenge the reader.
Yeah, it's like,
to sit through what he's doing.
I learned what felching is. Thanks. But, like, so this time, in reading it, like, in reading Guts, I mean, I was prepared for that. I was like, okay, I know what's gonna happen in this. I remember this. Like, I got it. Mm-hmm. And I feel like rereading it now, I know more what it's about. Like, that... Not that it's, like, hard to decode. It's, like, right there. He pretty much says it. It's, like, this is about pushing the envelope, about, like, just, you know, reaching to breathe, but 1 minute, I think, this is not an exact quote, because I can't quite remember it, but it's as close as I can remember. Like, 1 minute you're just some kid getting off, the next minute you're never going to be a lawyer. So it's like this sort of balance between consequence and exploration of the self and, like, sexuality in particular, like, kind of filtering into that. Mm-hmm. Like, that's something that I feel like I understand a lot more now, that I resonate a lot more with now. So, like... What interests me about that is I feel like part of the reason that I remember it is because I had such a powerful physical reaction to it. And, like, that almost kind of feels like my body responding to something that my brain was not ready to process yet. Like, when I was talking about Unshanandalu, I used the phrase, like, shock you into paying attention. Mm-hmm. And I think this is kind of, like, breaking that apart a little bit. It's like there's this physical response that precedes an intellectual response, but when done correctly is part of it. It's like, this is a story about your body responding to things, and your body responds to it.
Right.
Like, I think it's deployed very, very well, and, like, God, I don't want to like it, but I do. But I think that kind of gets at the heart of, like, what's cool about eliciting a visceral reaction. It's like, if art is about expression and about, like, gaining awareness, this is, like, being able to tap into that physical awareness as part of the experience. And, like, I don't really like gross out stuff necessarily, mm-hmm. but, like, it makes me want to encourage myself to kind of look at that more, just because it's like that can be something, you know?
Yeah. I think you would like Rant by Chuck Palahniuk.
Yeah.
It's like an oral history about a dude who's into a bunch of very odd but creative stuff. At one point, he creates an entire network for people who want to find car accidents before paramedics get there, so that they can just, like, see what the car accident looks like and then leave.
Huh.
But it's like a fictional oral history about him.
Okay.
I have it. I'll lend it to you. It's
I'm
my favorite. I've read probably half of what he's written, mm-hmm. and that's the thing that strikes me as, like, the most colorful and the least caught up in, like, this has to be about something that's going to challenge you.
Yeah. Just the most natural.
I mean, like, Choke was almost, like, giving up on needing to, like, mess with the reader. But, like, I don't know how many times he refers to his penis as my dog. In a completely unironic way.
I've never read Choke, but I love the movie.
I need to see the movie.
Yeah, because the movie is Sam Rockwell and Anjelica Houston.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Okay, I'm in. I keep on forgetting that Sam Rockwell is in it, because he's, like, right now probably my favorite actor.
Yeah, he's really good.
He has been for a while, but I feel like, I don't know, now that he's known for the Three Billboards. Like,
yeah, like, that's him getting a big break, but, like, fucking Moon.
Yeah, Moon, Seven Psychopaths he's amazing in,
mm-hmm.
Joshua is I'll probably talk about Joshua on this podcast at some point, but, I mean, it's a horror film about him realizing that his son is probably a murderer.
Yeah, I remember you mentioning that. Okay.
Oh, so good. Yeah, so fun thing about Guts.
Mm-hmm.
I was given I think it's called Ghost Stories. It's the first story in it. I was given that at lunch when I was, like, 17 in high school. And I read it while eating a taco bowl.
Oh, God. Oh, God.
That stuff does not get to me. I had to stop eating. Like, I had to stop and go, like, okay, you know what? It's either eating or reading this story, and right now, it's reading this story. Yeah, that was one of the things that sold me on Chuck Palahniuk.
Like, yeah, like, I don't know, it's kind of good.
I think it didn't consciously occur to me, but there's something really striking about reading something, and, like, everyone, we were passionate around the table, and everyone's going, like, ew! Like, shoulders hunching up, and, like, the arm is coming up in front of the face.
Uh-huh.
Like, people are flinching away from words on a page, and that's amazing. Like, as a writer, to be able to do that.
Ah, words are magic.
Alright, so I guess I will talk about the book that I chose.
Yeah, speaking of.
So this is a book called Perfume. It came out in 1986 by German author Patrick Susskind.
Okay.
I have a version that's translated by John Woods. I haven't read any other translations, and I don't know enough German to make a translation recommendation, but I found the Woods translation very nice.
Just as a quick side note, isn't that such, like, an interesting subset of literature?
The very first language arts, or English or whatever course I took in college was English European literature and translation. It was all stuff that was never in English originally. We read, like, Rimbaud, Rilke, Kafka, an amazing couple, like, Polish poets, Anna Swier, if you're into...
Mm-hmm.
Like, Cold War inspired gender politics poem. Susskind wrote this novel, Perfume. It's considered, like, one of the best German novels come out in the last many years. It's about this character. His name is Granui. He gets nicknamed the Tick since he is such an avid breastfeeder as a child. He goes through, like, 5 different wet nurses in the first 2 months of his life. They keep on going, like, no, he's sucking me dry, and he's also biting, so, like, no, you're gonna have to find someone else. So he becomes called the Tick. Yeah, they call him Too Greedy. As he becomes a child, he is, like, he never speaks. When he does, like, finally start speaking at the age of, like, 8, it's all, like, yes or no answers and, like, one-word responses. He understands the words, but he doesn't use them if he doesn't have to. He, over time, realizes that he has an unnatural sense of smell and decides that he's going to commit himself to becoming a perfumer.
Vaguely familiar.
So, the place that this book gets both weird and really visceral is that his sense of smell is so cultivated that the author spends whole paragraphs describing what things smell like. And it's, like, really evocative, the way that it's described. Like, the first time that it really struck me reading the book is when you smell a baby's head, it has a distinct smell. And they describe it as smelling like caramel and cow's milk. And speaking of cow's milk, they describe the smell of cow's milk as depending on the temperature of the cow's milk, which cow it comes from, what the cow's diet is like, the amount of cream that's left in it. Like, it gets incredibly in-depth with the way that things smell. You kind of get a sense of the way that Grenouille lives in the world. Getting just overwhelmed by smells. And the first time that he's truly overwhelmed by a smell, he smells this girl. She's like 12 years old. And she smells so wonderful that it drives him insane, and he strangles her to death so that he can, like, take her smell.
Okay.
And when he's done strangling her to death, he gets down over the ground and starts sniffing her entire body, trying to figure out, like, where does this combination of smells make this, like, cocktail that makes her so wonderful? And I wrote down some of the descriptions. He says, her sweat smells like a sea breeze. Her hair smells like tallow, which is both sweet and made with nut oil. He smells her genitals and says that they smell like water lilies. And her skin is like apricot blossoms. He figures out this method as a perfumer to put oil on the skin of a person directly after killing them and soak up their smell essence, which he then distills into perfumes. This is the meat of the book, is, like, his transformation from literal, like, just born to, at the very end, it's his death. But all along the middle, he's a perfumer. And it is one of the most visceral experiences I've ever had reading a book, just because they are appealing to your, like, less cultivated senses throughout. But there's something about his violence, because the name of the book is Perfume, but the subtitle is Story of a Murderer.
Yeah.
The violence is incredibly visceral. Like, they talk about, like, snuffing the life out of somebody in very particular, detailed ways, but, like, in such a way as to preserve the odor of the victim. It's very strange, and unfortunately I feel like I can't articulate very well the ways that it gets you, aside from just, I mean, like, I don't know, I feel like hopefully the examples give you some sense of...
Well, it's, I mean, I'm reflecting on the fact that, like, I mean, it's has been observed that we don't really have a lot of words for smells.
We don't.
Like, it's not really a verbalized sense very much, so, like, appealing to that kind of is interesting, first of all, like, as a project, but also, like, because your brain isn't used to, like, doing that, probably has a uniquely powerful effect.
It is. It's, I mean, I hope that I'm selling this right, because Perfume is one of the most amazing books that I've read in the last 5 years. I've done a fair amount of reading in the last 5 years. It's a really good one. It's just, it's so sort of ethereal It's like catching a whiff of perfume.
Mm-hmm.
You know exactly what you're talking about when you're thinking about it, but describe the way that a perfume smells to someone.
Right.
And somehow Susskind actually does that for an entire book. It's a feat of writing in as much as you always know what smell he's describing.
And I'm very curious now.
It's a good one.
Like, compounding that with translational issues.
Oh my god, it must have been miserable to be a translator for this.
I bet, yeah. Huh. No, that sounds really cool. I've heard of that. I feel like they made, at some point, maybe in the like mid-2000s, they made a film adaptation of it that was not well received, which is probably why I remember it, and also, like, just based on that description, I completely understand why it did not work.
No, I don't see this working as a film. There's a certain intimacy you need with the text.
Yeah.
And I think a book offers that in a way that, under the right conditions, it can where film can't.
Yeah, like, the written word is probably the closest to pure thought.
Right.
Because we think in words, mm-hmm. mostly, usually. There are exceptions to that, but...
But, I mean, to make ourselves understood to one another, we convert our thought into words, and that's why it's the medium that we find ourselves most comfortable with. Can you imagine trying to tell a story through, like, a series of smells?
In, like, the vaguest and most exciting sense, yes.
Yeah.
Like, which gets into all kinds of, like, language theory and stuff, which is fun, but I do not necessarily feel qualified to get to talk about.
So I guess that's our examples for this week. I have a couple quotes written down as potential titles.
Oh, okay. What do you got?
Did you have anything off the top of your head?
Ear Witness News kind of made me laugh.
Ear Witness News I like a lot. I wrote down, the lizard part of the brain doesn't understand the abstract, which is a little bit long, but I like it.
There could be a way to truncate that.
Right? Not shaped by forces of normal socialization. And just the question, does it matter?
I kind of like all of those. Alright, some fodder.
We'll mull over that in the next week, and the next time we record, we'll have decided.
Yeah, because, you know, fourth or fifth episode seems like...
Yeah, fourth episode.
Maybe it's about time. It's like kissing on the third date.
So do we have a theme for next? Yes, we do.
The theme for next time is going to be like epic things, which I don't know. Like, there's some room for interpretation there.
I'm
curious to see what you come up with.
My one example I know for sure is going to be epic in terms of scale.
Yes, I have one of those as well.
I'm pretty sure I have another example that's an epic in terms of both time and scale.
Ooh, okay.
We'll see.
Do you have some cool stuff to recommend this week?
I didn't think that... I've just been so wrapped up watching this TV show, which I'm going to talk about next week for the epic...
So you can't use that.
So I'm not going to do that. But I did just see an action movie I've been meaning to see for a while.
Oh.
And let me say... If I hadn't already had examples for Visceral, I would have gone with this one. It was the gut-wrenchingest, like, bloodiest action movie. Not, like, in terms of, like, amount of fake blood, but, like, just in terms of how brutal it is to the people in it.
In terms of execution, if you will?
Yes. It's called The Raid Redemption.
I've heard of that.
It's an Indonesian film. Here's my one-sentence description of how brutal it is. At one point, a dude gets... thoroughly murdered using a fluorescent light bulb.
Ooh. Ow.
Yeah. That was probably the most affected I was during the whole movie, but, like, Ooh. the general plot is a SWAT team goes into a housing project.
Yeah, like they kill everybody and they go up a floor, is how I've heard it described.
So they're just kind of like circulating through the building, and the resistance is heavily armed, and at a certain point everyone runs out of bullets, and that does not stop them from killing each other.
Well, I'm sure it doesn't.
No, it's like maybe halfway through the movie they're like all out of guns. It's just machetes and light bulbs and refrigerators.
Objects to hand.
Yeah. Man, they make a fucking bomb out of a propane tank, a refrigerator, and a hand grenade.
That sounds like a MacGyver setup.
It seems like it might actually work. Like, that was intense. Anyway, what do you have to recommend this week?
I have a couple of things. In different media. First, I have been listening a lot to the re-recording of the album Twin Fantasy by Carseed Headrest. He put it out in, I think, 2011 as, like, one of his many Bandcamp albums, and then, like, just now that he's a thing, has, like, gone back and re-recorded it in his studio and everything, and I'm not super familiar with the old one, but I'm liking the new one a lot. I also just started a video game because I was playing Fallout 4 and just got, like, not even very far into it, and I'm overwhelmed.
Yeah, it's overwhelming.
Like, Skyrim I can do because, like, swords and magic and stuff, like, that's a system I'm used to. Like, I can grok that. I don't have to think about it too hard. Like, factoring guns into the equation starts to get, like, there have been a couple points where it's like, why do I... But this bullet does not fit in this gun. I have no... Oh my god, I have no eye and I'm dead.
Yeah, it's, you don't have a lot of time to,
yeah,
to react.
Like, the like, post-apocalyptic thing, like, that's not a world, a milieu that I'm used to. So, like, it's a lot, because it's Bethesda.
Mm-hmm.
So, as a vacation from that, I'm playing Dragon Quest VIII. Which is a game that I've had 4 years and gotten around to, and then, like, was reading a couple, like, best JRPGs of all time lists, and it showed up on there, and I was like, oh, I have that, alright, and it's exactly what I want. It's, like, cel-shaded, turn-based active time battles, super linear storyline, yes. And then, as far as the last thing, I went, like, I had a little extra money this week that I did not expect to, because I am who I am, I set aside a portion of that to go buy something fun with, and was wandering through Suncoast, and ended up getting, Three Billboards, because that had just come out, and was on sale, actually. But also, they just released a complete series DVD edition of Duckman.
Ooh.
And I bought that, and I'm really excited about it.
That's the one with Jason Alexander?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, I watched so much,
yeah,
of that late at night.
Private dick family man whose best friend is a pig, has three sons and two bodies, lives with the twin sister of his dead wife, and a mother-in-law with so much gas she's a fire hazard. That was in the wrong order, but... I was also, like, looking at the list of, like, people who have guest starred on that, and of course, like, I'm kind of blanking on it now, but it's a very long list.
Yeah.
Like, anybody you can think of is on there. The only name that's coming to mind right now is Ron Perlman, and that doesn't count because Ron Perlman shows up in the weirdest places, but Tim Curry, I know, is, like, recurring on it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Dweezil Zappa's main cast.
Yeah. That was as confused a yeah as I could offer.
Yeah. It's by Klasky Sapo in the mid-90s. It's an animated sitcom. It was their first animated sitcom after The Simpsons, like, that production company kind of got the ball rolling on. It's weird as hell, but...
It really is.
In, like, a fun 90s kind of way. I don't know. The, like... It's a show that I watched a lot of as a kid and remember very fondly, but don't actually have super clear memories of, except for one. The, like, one sort of scene that I can remember is, like, Duckman, Jason Alexander, like, sitting alone in an attic, and, like, somebody comes in, I don't even remember who it is, and it's like, what are you doing in here? Are you masturbating? Oh, God, you were masturbating, weren't you? Now you're gonna have to start all over again. Way to go! I ruined the whole thing! And then, like, Jason Alexander's character goes off on this rant. No, no, like, I don't really masturbate that much. It's more for, like, you know, when you fall in love with somebody and you get so crazy and you build them up to this place and then fuck it up horribly and they won't talk to you, and that's when sex for one becomes a total delight. And just, like, I don't know. I'm really curious to see if it holds up.
Yeah, me too. It's been years and years since I've seen that.
All right. Well, that, I think, about does it, unless you have any final thoughts?
Not for this week.
Okay.
Just hoping I get some good examples for next week.
Next week should be a really long episode, because it's epics.
Yeah, we'll do, like, 15 episodes, or 15 examples each.
This podcast is 7 hours, so sit down.
That's dude, that could be that could be the title. So sit down. It's gonna be a 7-hour podcast. So sit down and shut the fuck up.
We're talking here. Did you do your homework? All right. Goodbye.
Yeah. Bye.